I'll reintroduce myself. My name is Aaron O'Forley. I'm an associate professor of African American literature and culture here at Washington State University Pullman, and I am your chair for this session that is entitled Black Indigenous Solidarity from AIM and the Black Panthers to Standing Rock and the George Floyd Uprising. And your presenters for this session is Danica Brown, Kent Ford, and Sky Wilson. I will give a little background for everyone about each presenter here. So I'm going to ask Danica to help me out a little bit with the pronunciation. So right here. So Danica Brown is Choctaw of the
White Crane Clan.
Thank you. White Crane Clan and Scottish of Clan Ross, born and raised in northern New Mexico. Her names are
Achichi Okshaluba and Odilini Fisher.
Okay, great. Which means honeysuckle breeze and morning star. She was a member of the American Indian Movement, the Denver Boulder chapter from 1988 to 2005. Was at Standing Rock and active in providing legal support to George Floyd rebels. She is an indigenous autonomous anarchist whose worldview emerges from a deep love and respect for the people, our ancestors, and for the can you pronounce that please, Danica?
It's our beloved Mother Earth.
Oh, just say our beloved Mother. Okay, I wanted to make sure I get the pronunciations right. Thank you. Our beloved Earth. All right. Thank you very much, Danica. And then also we have Kent Ford, who was co-founder of the Portland, Oregon chapter of the Black Panther Party in the 1960s. He volunteered for years at the Panthers Free Breakfast for School Children's Program in Portland, which daily fed hundreds of children in Northeast Portland. I did a research project on them. Mr. Ford. He also volunteered for years in supportive roles with the Panthers Free Medical and Dental Clinics in Portland. He currently leads Black Panther Legacy Tours of the Portland Albina neighborhood. A tireless advocate for justice, he is the subject of the solo play, Walking Through Portland with a Panther, The Life of Mr. Kent Ford by Don Wilson Glenn and directed by Damaris Webb. And we have Sky Wilson, who is originally from Minnesota, has been a member of the Clark County community since 2007 when he moved to Vancouver to teach and finish his doctoral degree at Washington State University. For nearly two decades, his research and work has focused on community organizing and local communities creating alternative community-based structures. He has worked both in academia and with grassroots or community organizations. In 2019, Sky created the structure for and facilitated a two-year equity collaborative composed of 14 healthcare and community-serving organizational partners across Southwest Washington. Through the pandemic, Sky served as the equity and inclusion manager for a local health department in Oregon and currently supports equity work in Oregon's largest library system. As the son of a white Portlanders and Black Jamaican immigrant, Sky has maintained a long-term focus on race and critique of racism to understand and respect to inequitable social, political, and economic structures in more effective ways. Sky brings this focus to all his roles as a consultant, educator, husband, and parent. Please join me and if you're not on screen, if you don't mind, just giving a show a little hand clap. And if you're on screen, just join me in giving a little quick hand clap to all of our presenters and we'll start. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. First is Danica. Danica, take it away.
I'll just talk a little bit about my experience. Halito Achichi Okshaluba Hilili Fish, I'm Danica. I have a terrible head cold. It's just stuck right in my head. So I'll get through this day. But I was born and raised in northern New Mexico. And my grandfather was watches Standing Buffalo. And his Christian name was Little Joe Gomez. My father is Richard Brown. He's a man with the Native American church. And so I grew up in the Native American church. And my mother, who's Scottish, her family were members of the Communist Party in the 50s. And my great aunt Ola was a grand jury resister during 1958. And so I come from a long line of resistors. And so for me, when I ran away from home when I was 16 and moved to Denver, Colorado. And soon there, I met up with Russell Means at a presentation he was doing, and got recruited into the American Indian Movement. And I was a member of the American Indian Movement until 2005 when I left, primarily because of the misogyny within our organization. But in the time, you know, at that time in Denver in the 90s, there was a lot of white supremacist organizing. There was during the Martin Luther King day, there was a group of from the Denver Skins who were a neo-Nazi skinhead group, skin street gang. One of the leader of that organization who was tied to Tom Messer's group really wanted to kind of organize with the Ku Klux Klan and wanted to build ties between the white Aryan resistance and the Ku Klux Klan. There was a lot of there was a lot of bad blood between those two organizations. And so Sean Slater wanted to kind of build that. So his idea was to have on Martin Luther King Day these rallies to talk about white supremacy. And at the time there wasn't really like anti-fascist organizing against those kinds of events. And so the American Indian Movement at the time, we got together with a number of other organizations to fight against that. And consequently, if you Google Denver riots of 1992, you'll see there were like these massive riots that happened. And for 3 years, Sean Slater was having his little rally where the police would come and, you know, there would be like 50 of them Sig Heiling and doing their little, you know, wear their little hoods and running around and being protected by the police. And then these just massive riots would happen in reaction to it. And so for 3 years that happened, and it was the American Indian Movement that was really the kind of the leading organization fighting against those. But we were also working across different other organizations like Black-led organizations and Chicano-led organizations, and then our white allies were American Friends Service Committee. Gotta really love those nights; they're pretty awesome. But so for 3 years we fought against that, and then finally we realized, well, they're getting permits, so we ended up just getting the permits for Martin Luther King Day for the state capitol. After that, for 5 years, and they no longer had their little rally. And so those were kind of some of the things that we did. But in that time, you know, I think that we were really like interested in working cross culturally and cross organizationally to, you know, defend our community against white supremacy. And so a lot of the work that we did was around cross collaboration. And so, you know, I did a lot of like studying, particularly the Black Panthers and other organizations, the Chicano movement. And so I was doing a lot of studying and reading, and there was a number of study groups that we were doing, and really kind of leaning towards the work that the Black Panthers had done, in particular around studying and understanding colonialism and understanding imperialism in the United States and understanding our enemy. And that was, I think, one of the greatest lessons that I learned from the Black Panthers was that. And through that process, what I started to understand was how intimately tied our historic legacies are. In the United States, this country was founded, and the capital that created this country came from the stealing of land from tribal people and the enslavement of Black people. And so although our experiences are not the same, they're intimately tied together. And so for me, I really wanted to understand what that looked like and started building collaborations across with Black organizers and studying with them and creating Black and Indigenous solidarity movements and organizations. And so when I moved to Portland, Oregon, at that time, too, I was also doing a lot of political prisoner support, primarily for Leonard Peltier. But then I became a member of the American Indian, Anarchist Black Cross. And Mr. Ford's son was also a political prisoner at that time. And I had started doing political prisoner support for his son. And then I moved to Portland. And so when I moved to Portland, Mr. Ford had come. We had had a birthday party for Leonard Peltier. It was his 70th birthday. And Mr. Ford came to that event, and that's really where I got to know him and met him. And, you know, he shared a story. If you don't mind me sharing, Mr. Ford, I'll share this story. That when his son was put into prison, he was put in one of the first prisons he was put into was the same prison that Leonard was being housed at. And, Leonard kind of took his son under his wing and took care of him. And that Mr. Ford felt like he had a relationship with Leonard because of his relationship with his son, and had a great deal of gratitude towards Leonard for doing that and taking care of his son when he was in prison. And I kind of started hanging out with Mr. Ford and, building a relationship with him. And then back after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson in the Mike Brown case, we started organizing in Portland. A number of different kind of anarchist and communist groups started organizing and working with the Albina Ministerial Alliance to organize some protests. We saw that, Darren Wilson wasn't going to be indicted, and we wanted to organize some things around that. And so we started working with the Black community and other community members to organize a rally, which we ended up doing. And it was pretty successful. I got arrested. That wasn't fun. But, but we really wanted to start organizing. And then at the same time, when the Black Lives Matter started, there was a small group of young Black people in Portland that we started collaborating with, and we started an African Indigenous solidarity group. And we just started doing a political study, getting together, reading Black and Indigenous political literature, studying the Black Panthers, studying the American Indian movement, studying other resistance movements across the country, and developing solidarity and camaraderie across our communities. And what I'll say is that, like, I think some of the deepest political work I've ever done was sitting in a room with Indigenous and Black organizers from all over the country, eating food, drinking some wine, and talking politics. It's like the most powerful work I've ever done, better than getting arrested. But, and building relationships with people like Mr. Ford, and every day I learn more and more from him. So part of that work actually ended up happening. I was a doctoral student at the time, so I didn't have a wage labor job that was like I was tied to. And then a few years later, Standing Rock happened, and I had reached out. I have a friend who lives at Standing Rock. She was one of the first protesters arrested back in April, 2016. And the camp had started getting bigger, and I reached out to her and just asked her what was going on and what kind of support she needed. And she said that there were a lot of women in the camp who didn't have access to feminine hygiene and reproductive care. So we organized and got together a group of people, raised some money and pulled together. And we essentially developed a doula clinic in the camp. We had all kinds of reproductive health care services and providers. We had doulas. We had talking circles. We provided birth control. We provided hygiene care. And in the long run, we ended up birthing 3 babies in the camp. We had a teepee that we had, and we had a big army tent. And so we ended up just essentially building a women's health clinic in the camp. And I lived in the camp for a month, and then I left the camp because I understood there was a warrant out for my arrest. And so I left the camp and just continued to support the Wianan camp, which is the women's camp, which then kind of turned into the Two Spirit and women's camp. And, but while I was there, there was a woman, her name is Yvonne, and her son, she's African and indigenous, Afro-Indigenous, and her son was 5 years old. And there's a very famous video of from Democracy Now! Where we were captured confronting the private security company. And this young boy who was with us, he also was, she was the granddaughter of Louis Farrakhan. And he and I, her son and I, kind of bonded and connected, and we were together. And we actually, the reason that we kind of broke the line and crossed over was because Yvonne and her son were on the other side of the fence, and these dogs were coming towards her and her son to attack them. And so we crossed the fence to create a barrier between the dogs and this 5-year-old boy, African, Afro-Indigenous boy. And so while we were there, there was just a lot of solidarity across movements in that space. I wanted to show just a short video from Standing Rock, if you don't mind. It's just a few minutes long.
Uchakpi uyate heno ukiepi. Ma kakanesho hipi hinka he. Ia he kata naha maniki lesni. Na wajila heche iapi hinka ukile waka. He etaha heche apetukle he woksape he na wopre na heche yake. Apetukle heche taki ungla kapi. Yukha makha sitomia ungla kapi.
Your desktop, but we don't see a video. So if we're supposed to be seeing a video.
Let me try again. Yeah.
Please do. Thank you.
Can you see it now?
Now we can. Yes. Thank you.
I'll start at the beginning. Sorry
about that. No
problem. Uchakpi uyate heno ukiepi. Ma kakanesho hipi hinka he. Ia he kata naha maniki lesni. Na wajila heche iapi hinka ukile waka. He etaha heche apetukle he woksape he na wopre na heche yake. Apetukle heche tauki ungla kapi. Hiukha makha sitomnia he ungla kapi. Hiukna wahunupa wahutopa hupa kuzo makashko yati. Ina wache kuka kapi. Na apetukle he u hechoa mitaki uyasi. Apetukle he ona wopre kakapi ina Uglaksapi on na oyateki he tehia he nachi wayangapi naha letaha oyate wichoyeki le utefike heche sampraya heche wayangapi kte. Otrake heha wakantaka head duktogana makakaneche wichoyik de he ukupi naha makakaneche duktogana yuash de yuakha hena wichokha ki yake.
So I just kind of wanted to share that video because I think it beautifully explains like why we were at Standing Rock, and that it wasn't just about the Standing Rock people, but you know, the Missouri River feeds into the Mississippi River, which is the primary water source for 16 million people. And so when we were talking about fighting for and defending the land and water, it was for all people. And so that's why I wanted to show that video. And I think the last thing I'll talk about a little bit is that really in the last 4 years, I've been working a lot with Mr. Ford, and we really were working hard during the George Floyd uprisings to support uprisers and resistors in that space. And we ended up raising $1.5 million to provide legal support and aid to people who are being arrested during George Floyd. And we developed what we call a legal doula program. So we had volunteers that just showed up and supported people through the process. And consequently, even now, years later, we're still doing that support work, primarily for the people who are being most severely prosecuted from that time, even though it was a lot of non-Black and non-white people or non-Indian people there. The primary defendants right now are Black and Indigenous and Afro-Indigenous people. And so there was really a clear disparity of who the police were targeting and consequently who the state was targeting. And the person who's been sentenced to the most time, his name is Malik, and he is looking at 20 years in prison, where other people are not looking at that kind of time. And we have a number of Black Indigenous women who are currently going through the process, and we're currently supporting them, paying their legal fees, and making sure that they have money on their books to be able to live as comfortably as they can under incarceration in this country. And with that, so I'll just leave that at that, and I'll pass it on to the next presenter.
Thank you, Danica. Mr. Kent, you are up now.
My turn, okay? It's my turn, sir?
Yes, it is, sir.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you, everyone, for having me and invite me. And what a wonderful panel it was this morning and this afternoon. And appreciate all the work that everybody's committed to the struggle and to the freedom. And I should say, I don't want to quote George Bush, but freedom and democracy, you know, everybody. And I go here to say, start off by saying, Danica mentioned post George Floyd and during the George Floyd uprising. She didn't mention that. That they raised all this money to bail people out of jail and mutual aid vans and printed pocket lawyers, and they were down every night. And the most beautiful thing was having a group of Native people that ran around across from the Justice Center, you know, beating their drums in a circle, you know, and it was really powerful. And it just all came together, you know, and for some reason, night after night, I've never been so proud to be from Portland, Oregon in all my life. For 100 days, not set the stage for America, but the world. We sustained and maintained the protest. And I think I was joking with somebody who said, you know, some cities strive for greatness. Some kids or some cities are born to be great, but Portland had greatness thrust up on them, you know. And this is one time the struggle wasn't outgunned and it wasn't outnumbered. And we took it to them night after night after night. And we have to continue to build on that. And the Black Panther Party had a 10-point platform and program in 1966. A group of Marriott College students came up with a 10-point platform and program. And number seven, we want to immediately end the police brutality and murder of Black people. That's more valid today than it was written back in 1966. And I want to say this. Civil rights was a miserable failure. It got a few jobs for some people, but it never did filter down to the people that they're killing on the streets. And every year, you know, since they've been tracking these police murders in America, it's been 1,000, 1,100, 1,200. They started tracking these murders in 2015. And you guys can pull it up. And fact check me on anything I say. Again, I said this morning, in the whole European Union, only 10 people got arrested by the police last year. Go figure, you know. I think we accomplished more, since post-George Floyd and civil rights accomplished in over 50 years. The same thing we were struggling back during the civil rights movement, voter suppression, voters registration, people like Fannie Lou Hamer, Dr. King, Malcolm, and all of them was out there. I want to say this before I forget it. Fannie Lou Hamer was in the civil rights movement, worked with SNCC and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She went back to her sharecropper ranch, and the county sent her a $9,000 water bill, and she didn't even have indoor plumbing in the house. You know, go figure, you know. So anyway, what happened? That's where the Black Panther got started at, in Lowndes County, Alabama. And just the thing, when you see the Black Panther, you just pull a lever. And racism persists and persists. And then the war in Vietnam came along, and we had with the peace movement hooked up with the civil rights movement, and things evolved from that. And then the Students for a Democratic Society, the AIM guys, the Crusade for Justice, the Brothers and Sisters out of Colorado, those were some powerful groups to get the struggle from where it was back then to where we are today. Things have evolved a bit. So what we're doing here is we took all our cues, the party did, from the man we call, I call X. And I tell people on a walking church, you know, we had to listen to James Baldwin, a study Baldwin, though. We studied Malcolm, you know. We would have fixed it back then. We wouldn't have to be bothered with trying to fix it now, you know. But this time, you know, let's fix it once and for all. But that said, I think I've said this again this morning, I'm going to repeat it this afternoon. You have a knife in somebody 9 inches, you pull it out 6 inches, that's not progress. Just pull it out all the way and treat the original wound. With that said, I think what we want to do is move the struggle, take the struggle forward, you know, and we want better schools. Nobody paid us. We wasn't on anybody's payroll. This thing about critical race theory and woke and all that stuff and teaching people their history, you know, we know what that's all about. It's the same thing, you know, why they want to suppress the votes and everything. We get calls, you know, now and then, you know, go out to colleges and universities, and people come on my walking tours and stuff like that. We didn't plan this. We didn't plan this 50 years later, or over 55 years later. No, if you'd have told me back in the late 60s that I'd be doing this today, you know, I'd say, oh, you guys just go ahead on with that. You know, I wouldn't have believed you. And they, but it's just white supremacy, you know, thing that and white supremacy, I want to stress this, education system, you guys are professors and educators and scholars and researchers and everything. And I tell all the guys I meet, I love all you guys, but you have to learn it out here on the street. You know, we're revolutionary socialists, and we organize from the sidewalk down. And one thing about organizing now, and everybody's already been to hell, and I've never even had a chance in America. And nobody can betray you. Nobody can roll you. And I'm going to say, we had the platform was about land, bread, housing, decent jobs, decent education. And with that said, again, I want to cut it off here. And it's the questions that really get me going. You know, I can take it back over 50 years and bring you up to speed today. But how many ask everybody here, you know, the scholars, the researchers, the professors and everything, how many ask you to keep up your good work, stay in the fight? You know, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And I tell the guys, we used to say out on the streets, you know, you never cross over. You never go to the other side. You never kiss up to power. And we should have these political education classes every Wednesday up at Martin Luther King School. And now it used to be Highland School, and it was the Highland neighborhood. And we had certain books we would read out of, and we have a reading list and everything. And 40 and 50 to 70 people would turn out every Wednesday. And that's where the party in Poland formed out of. And this was after the death of Malcolm X, and in between the death of Malcolm X and in between the both assassination of Malcolm X and Dr. King. And we just tried to reach out to the community. The area we had the clinics in, and the dental clinic, the health clinic, the breakfast program. The city had completely written off that area. And go figure. And so we said, okay, fine. And this is why we put the buildings that we put our health clinic. We had our own buildings. Every city buildings or the county buildings or the state buildings, we had to run a program. We had our own program that we run our 10-point platform and program out of. And I came into the struggle via the peace movement, via the Vietnam War. And for some reason, when Muhammad Ali said, no Vietnamese ever called me that word, I took it to here, and then I took it to heart. Then I hit the streets with the Black Panther Party newspapers. And so that's pretty much all I have to say. When the paper came out every week, we did over 100,000 sickle cell tests. We've seen hundreds of patients every week at the health clinic. And again, I want to say, if they don't come after you, you know, when they come after you, you know you must be doing something right. And if they don't come after you, you're not doing nothing right. And, you know, we did like Ali would say, we bobbed and we weaved, we float like butterflies, we sting like bees. But we always stuck to one thing. And the people had our backs, we had theirs. And we started out at the Black Panther Party for self-defense. We went into voters registration, dental care, health care, breakfast program, preschool, eliminate that preschool to prison pipeline. You guys know about that. And it came out with everything they had. When we first got started, the biggest Black population in Salem, Oregon was the Oregon State Penitentiary. Go figure, you know. And the lady came out and bailed me out. I was able to organize my case. Got out. I knew they had nothing. You can't put a person in jail for talking on the street corners every day, talking to the young people about not going to Vietnam, not joining the military, because 3 months later, you're going to be on, like Dr. King said, you're going to be on the front line in Vietnam fighting somebody that you don't even know. You're not president. And this includes Obama also. Until you bomb some little far-off village 10,000 miles away and kill up some people in the country. And he was good at that. You know, I called him, do your scholars, your history professors, do your research on that. He was a drone, the drone warfare president, more drone strikes than George Bush the second you could ever imagine. And with that said, we want to keep it in the streets. We want to keep things moving, build on what we accomplished in the last several years, and they're going to come after us. They're going to hit us with everything they got. But I feel we got some serious changes coming. And I want to close out with that. And I want to thank everyone for having me. And I'll be more than happy to take any questions that you have for as long as you want to after the next speaker.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Poore. Okay, Dr. Sky Wilson.
Thank you. And I first want to register that this is, it's an absolute honor to be on a panel with Danica and Mr. Ford. It's wonderful to meet you, Danica, and good to see you again, Mr. Ford. Thank you for the lifelong work towards creating a future for us. I want to again take up some of the themes that each of you have spoken to. With that, I am a little bit about the perspective that I'm coming to this with. My mother was from Portland, but I was born in and grew up mostly in Minneapolis. When I was born, I lived in the Phillips neighborhood, just a block away from the Little Earth community in Minneapolis that was a center of organizing for the American Indian Movement. And so I saw the service that folks were putting in, the community work and organizing that folks are putting in to keep the community safe. That was done internally. It wasn't done from the state. It wasn't done with state funding. It was done by people in the community putting in work to create a future for the community. Minneapolis has a open school policy. So I did. Later, I grew up in a housing project that was in Cedar Riverside that was just south of the Phillips neighborhood. And I drove through Phillips and went to a school further south Minneapolis called Clara Barton. At Barton, it was a few blocks from a lake. Minneapolis is a city of lakes. The one that was next to this school was called Lake Calhoun. Lake Calhoun named after John C. Calhoun, who was a former vice president, Secretary of War, a key administrator in the creation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So at the end of the year, at field days and special occasions, we would get to walk to this lake that is in the neighborhood. And at that time, it wasn't, and this is back in the late 70s, early 80s, at that time, it's not that we didn't know that Calhoun was a slave owner, that he was a key figure in the colonization of the United States and in Indian removal and genocide. It wasn't not known. People had organized to try to respond, to try to change the relationship to this lake and the name. Later, much later, and around was about 12 years ago, there began to be some additional energy picked up to changing the name of this space by the city, by the county, and by the park administration. And from that point, it still took another 9-10 years until based in this critique of John C. Calhoun as a slave owner, as someone who was intimately connected to genocide, the genocide of through colonization, who had written about his belief that Black people's value only lay in the exploitation of their labor. That was the full expression of what Blackness could be for him. So even with all of that, it still took this ongoing organization that began in the community. Eventually, the state picked it up. And then at this point, they did, the first it was the Park Board, then it was the city. They changed the name to Bede Makuska. And so Bede Makuska, a Dakota name for this lake, but still there is people in the community who reject the name change. A reorientation of the name to its pre-colonial name. But there's still this resistance that's rooted in this. It's only because it was through organizing, collective organizing, collaborative organizing that connected both the critique of Calhoun, and this actually was picked up after the Charleston shooting in 2015, to reorient and re-energize this movement to change the name. The reason I bring up this example is because I had a mentor, Asfar Hussein, who, when he speaks about colonization, he speaks of it in these four spheres: land, labor, language, and the body. And this, so it's these four sites of colonization that continue, that colonization is a constant regulation and control of these four sites: land, labor, language, and the body. And so that example speaks to ways in which each one of these spheres is constantly being kind of seen as these sites for control. And it's only when we develop an analysis that's able to connect these four pieces that we're able to develop an analysis that connects local struggles to organizing efforts, to broader organizing efforts. Danica spoke, appreciated the piece you mentioned about our experiences weren't the same, but they're intricately tied together. And it's this broad systemic view that allows us to develop collective strategies that have local expressions and tactics. So if we're only looking at the local, if we're only looking at local challenges, local obstacles to access to resources, et cetera, then we're not able to connect how these local organizing efforts are connected to bigger systemic structures. So again, it's this analysis that allows us to develop collective strategies that have local expressions and tactics to address the specific material conditions of our communities. And to me, that's what Black power was. Black power was a local expression of a broader strategy, power to the people. Because the organizing is happening in the Black community, then here's this expression, this local expression, but it's connected. And we were able to see the systemic links between what's happening in one community and another community. Fred Hampton's Rainbow Coalition, the pulling together of folks with specific experiences. They're not unique, they're specific. A few years ago, it was when the new Jim Crow, the Alexandra, but the new Jim Crow, the analysis of mass incarceration. When that text came out, it did an amazing job at linking the institution of slavery to mass incarceration or the prison industrial complex. It did a great job connecting these pieces. In the first chapter, she speaks to how one family line, she tracks one family line back, the paternal line back five generations, and speaks to the disenfranchisement through those five generations. Disenfranchised, politically disenfranchised as enslaved, politically disenfranchised because of white terrorism and the Ku Klux Klan, disenfranchisement based on literacy tests and poll tax. And then finally, Javaris Cotton, who was disenfranchised because he was on parole, identified as a felon, disenfranchised and on parole. And that's incredibly important work. But I think what's also necessary is not just tracking it back to the institution of slavery, but seeing the connections between the institution and slavery and colonization. So we have some folks have addressed the link between Angola, Louisiana State Penitentiary, which is the largest prison in this nation of prisons. Something like 18,000 acres. You have this massive land tract of land that is housing 5,100 inmates, three quarters of whom are Black. And so this Angola, Louisiana State Penitentiary is named Angola because it's on the land that was formerly a slave plantation called Angola. So the original inmates who after the Civil War were predominantly Black were housed in former slave quarters. But it's named Angola because of the person who created that plantation, Isaac Franklin, who worked slaves who were from Angola. Angola was the first African territory to be colonized. It became a major site from which Black people were stolen and transported to the Americas. So what is important about this is to see that the institution of slavery and colonization are both intimately connected. You don't have one without the other. And this is fed into a specific system in our contemporary world that has created certain a political economy and certain relations of productions that are being maintained, even if we're experiencing it specifically, we are still impacted by this system. And so for me, what I like to emphasize is that systemic analysis. It can be easy to see our local struggles as unique because there's specific expressions of how the exploitation, oppression, and degradation is showing up. But to see those links allows us to be strategic with the tactics that we have locally. Mr. Ford spoke to a little bit about the work that folks put in, not just in the reading, not just in the theory, not just in building understanding, but connecting that building and understanding to practice, to organizing, to work in the street. I want to point to Malcolm X for a moment, who was a key figure in my understanding of how we change the geography of the work. Speaking to the civil rights kind of the civil rights movement as a failure, and that civil rights movement contains the struggle within the citizenry. Who has access to the nation, who identifies with the nation. And then from there, the struggle is maintained within a particular scope of the current institutions and structures. It's when we're able to change the scope of the geography, and this is something that Malcolm pushed much further ahead, is we're not just wrestling with civil rights, we're wrestling with human rights. We're not just Negroes, we are Afro-Americans. And then that develops, that identity develops. But what it did is it connected struggle in the United States to the struggles for liberation in Asia, Africa, and South America, and across the Americas, the decolonizing efforts across the Americas. And so it's in that, just that shift in changing of scope of the struggle from just local, from just within the current institutions and structures to bridge out to struggles for liberation in these multiple sites, and seeing the ways that these are all connected in dynamic ways. And so, I'll stop there. I want to save time for you all to be able to ask questions to the group. And so I appreciate again the work that you all do. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. All right, we have a little bit of time for questions. Any questions? Any questions? Okay, well, I guess I can ask a question here. Look, Dr. Wilson, you're about to say something? It looked like you leaned in to say something.
Oh, no, okay. Thank you.
Oh, okay, sure. So my question is for the panel is, and I'm just sort of, just, you know, generally understand, I'm generally interested in how do you, and just, and it's sort of like just in your perspective and sort of thinking about, you know, what you've seen, in particular, Danica and Mr. Ford, what you've seen in the past versus where we are now in terms of how we protest and how we are protesting. Do what you see now, particularly how folks came together to protest the murder of George Floyd, does that give you hope for this new generation? Or do you sort of kind of look at this new generation and think, you know, that... that there's some things that, you know, that they still need to learn, right? Yeah, this is for Danica Masor, and even, you know, Sky, you can weigh in as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that Mr. Ford says is the easy part is getting in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easy part. The hard part is organizing after, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's our job, is to organize. And back in 2016, when Trump was throwing in his hat, and people were really concerned about their safety, we started organizing some presentations and meetings around what community defense is. And we took our kind of definition of community defense from the Black Panthers. But at the time, there was a lot of fear that young people, Black and Indigenous and queer people, really were having, because we were already seeing a spike in violence against these communities. And there was a young Black woman, she was like 23 at the time, and she said, we had a meeting, we were kind of talking about what is community defense.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, and I'll never forget this, she said, the antidote to fear is community organizing, that we need to build community. And that really stuck with me, because it seems really simple, but building community is really, really hard.
Yeah.
Because we're human beings and we're complicated and we have different needs. We're all trying to survive capitalism. But like I was saying earlier in my presentation, I think some of the most powerful political work I've ever done, mm-hmm. was having sharing food and building community with and across movements. And some of the most important, organizing work I do is, building those relationships and listening and learning from people who've done this work for a lot longer than I have, like Mr. Ford. Yeah. And so, when we have strong communities, we don't need the police. When we have strong communities, we take care of each other. When we have strong communities, we don't need to rely on the state for our basic human needs. Mm-hmm. But we don't know, because colonization, one of the points of colonization is to separate and divide. Like, we're really entrenched in that idea. Like, my property line is right here and my neighbor's is right over there, and you don't cross that property line. And we're really entrenched in that idea. And so I think we need to counter that, and that it's really, really hard, and it takes a lot of time, and it's not fancy, right? It's not like being on the streets is actually easy, and it's exciting and it's sexy. And it's like, and even if it's hard, it's still like, there's this energy to it where, like building community, building relationships is really the hard part. But in the long run, like, that's, I think, what we need to do to survive is to build those relationships across movements.
Okay, sure. Here, this is a question directly for Mr. Ford, and the question is that you spoke about Obama's drone strike program and his perpetuation of global hegemony. Does this demonstrate some of the limits of representational politics? Mr. Ford, does this?
Yes. You use a powerful word there, hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
The empire, what is it, 800 military installments in over two-thirds of the world's countries. And there's no reason why you got some guys out in the middle of a desert meeting every night over a fire drinking tea. A bomber has to take off, fly 10 hours to get there and drop a 500-pound bomb on them. A man leaving a village in Yemen, is hit by a drone strike and he's an American citizen. That should be no reason for that. And, look, you guys, all of you, Guantanamo Bay is still open.
Mm-hmm.
You got a half a dozen of guys that have never been charged yet. We had a president that promised to close it. Go figure. And look at the state of the Supreme Court just right now. There's some of the revelations that are coming to light within just in the last week. And and I'm not a fan of Donald Trump's or anything like that. But how does the DA in Manhattan, out of one charge, come up with 32 charges out of one charge? I don't quite understand that. I hope he has a strong case. It matters less to me whether they get him or not. And I just wanted to weigh in on that. And it's the who was it? Somebody says the Democrats or the Republicans. The man that brought me into the party way back in 1970. He stated, every 4 years, you got to, the most racist are the least racist. The Democrats got plenty of racists in the party. And that's what it is. Republicans, they walk their talk. And we don't want you voting. We don't want you doing this. We don't want you doing that. We don't want you registering. And we're going to pass every law where we can win every year and run things. And I appreciate your question there.
Okay, thank you. And then here's one for
Could I add a little bit to that as well? I think I appreciate that question as well. And, in the United States, there's been a confusion and conflation between liberal electoral politics and democracy. Those two things aren't the same, but we're pitched this narrative that this is what democracy looks like. This is what participation or political engagement looks like. But within, as Mr. Ford was just speaking of, the least racist of the racist, at the end of the day, there's still a racist. And so if we see this liberal electoral process as the expression of democracy, then we take away any real meaningful political agency. We just contribute to that ongoing hegemony, which leads to either someone who is explicitly or racist or an imperialist, or more subvertly or has a facade of not, but at the end of the day continues to perpetuate this hegemony.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, here's another question for you to respond to. Well, actually, I think anyone can sort of respond to this, but so we can, since Scott, you were talking, start with Sky, and then Danica, you can pick this one up too, if you want. Shamim wrote, I love this idea of, I'm sorry. I love this idea of the connected interconnectedness of the struggles and the importance of understanding the larger story of oppression and colonization. How does this knowledge impact how we do the work of justice in these times?
I think what that suggests for me is a return to a radical approaches to a radical analysis and approaches. So if we are to just look at kind of these liberal practices, like how do we increase representation in the current structures, or how do we increase access to different structures and institutions and expressions of in politics? If we focus on those pieces, we're going to be competing. We're going to continue to compete in this no-win scenario where you might change the color of inequity, but you will never change inequity itself. You will never address the impacts of ongoing colonization. And so to me, what this means, what that knowledge means for how we work on justice, is we need to create space for us to have those radical conversations, because they're ridiculously hard to have in our current institutions, because the institutions are built on naturalizing what they do. So this is it's natural to have to link capitalism and democracy together, for instance. Oh, that's just a natural relationship. When we take a radical approach, a radical analysis, we see that that's not a natural connection. That's a narrative that's created that we need to uncreate, that and both in concept and in practice.
Danica, this is for you. How have anarchist ideas shaped your participation in the AIM and the Standing Rock uprising?
Excuse me. A couple things. I particularly identify as an Indigenous autonomist, which is a little bit different in kind of like Western or Eastern European theories of anarchy. And then historically, like my culture, I'm Choctaw, we had anarcho democratic processes for dealing with conflict and dealing with government, or the way that we structured leadership and stuff like that. So for me, like the heart of anarchist principles are Indigenous principles, that we live in balance with each other, that, you know, the goal of anarchy is to confront oppression in all its domains, whether it be, you know, white supremacy, patriarchy, misogyny, capitalism, whatever it is. And so for me, the struggle with working within organizations like the American Indian Movement, the struggle was for me was really like the lack of that organization to address its patriarchal structures. And so consequently, a lot of women left the American Indian movement at that time. And, you know, that was part of a lot of different movements of that era, was the misogyny was pretty intense. And it's just a legacy that we have to continue to address. But for me, I think that, like, in thinking about organizing across movements as an anarchist, and so I put in the chat a link to the St. Paul's principles, which, you know, St. Paul's principles are very simple. It's like we need a diversity of tactics. And so for me as an anarchist, I'm never going to tell Black people how to organize. Mm-hmm. I just show up and offer to support in the best ways that I can. And, you know, Mr. Ford and I, you know, we talk about this a lot. Like, there's certain people in our organizations and our movements that we don't mess with because their political ideology is not aligned with us. Mm-hmm. But a diversity of tactics is, I think, an important part of it. And that actions and tactics used will be organized to maintain a separation of time and space. So, you know, like when we did the Mike Brown protest, you know, the Alberta Ministry Alliance had a very clear agenda, and they wanted, you know, due to a very specific kind of rally, and we supported that. And then afterwards, we separated from their space and we went and did a very more kind of direct action, but to, you know, creating space between those different actions. And, you know, any debate that we have or criticisms stay within the movement. And so for me, like, I don't criticize other movements on social media. Like, if I have an issue with someone, I'll contact them and have a conversation, because when we put all our dirty laundry out on the internet, we're doing cop work. We're doing pig work. We're giving the state and our enemies information against us. So I think it's really important that we keep any kind of criticism of each other out of social media, but we have conversations. But that's part of having a relationship with people within the movement, is that if I have an issue with someone, I can call them and say, hey, I want to talk to you about this particular thing. And the fourth principle is that we oppose any state repression of dissent, including surveillance, infiltration, disruption, and violence. And we agree not to assist law enforcement in actions against activists or other people. And so for me, those are the four principles that really kind of lead my work across movements.
Okay. So we're coming to the end. We have about 5 minutes left. And so I'm going to sort of ask a question to have each of you all respond to. And it's a prompt. And the prompt is, as far as my activism goes, I will continue to. And I like to get each person to respond to that prompt. So again, the prompt is, as far as my activism goes, I will continue to, and tell us what you will continue to do. And let's start with Mr. Ford, please.
Thank you. As far as my activism goes, I will continue to support Palestine, continue to keep the struggle in the streets against police brutality and harassment and murder. And I'll continue supporting the people. You never abandon people. And they didn't abandon me when they had me locked up. And I'm not going to abandon them. And I'll be 80 years old in a couple of months. And I'm going to take it to my grave, you guys. Power to the people.
All right, great. Danica, please.
I will continue to organize centering the love of our people and the liberation of all our people. Okay. And all power to the people.
Absolutely. Great. Dr. Wilson.
Yeah, I will continue to take my lead from people in the community. And that means, you know, strong people don't need strong leaders. And so I believe in taking the lead from those who are putting in the work. And all power to the people.
Great. All right. Thank you. Let's see. Make sure I got all the questions in the chat here. It looks like I did. Yeah. Okay. We're good. All right. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Have a good day, everyone.
Thank you all. Thank you.
I hope people will join us for the next session, which is the reading by Lana Jack. So I put the